Hi, this is Joe Patty. Thanks for listening to WRTI Online. This service is made possible through the support of WRTI's members. You can become a member, too. Since you're already online, just visit www.wrti.org and click the Become a Member link on the upper left corner of the webpage. You can also join us by phone at 1-866-809-9784. Your membership will help keep WRTI's broadcast and online services strong. And again, thank you. Now, on with the show.
Hello?
Mr. Zuckerman.
Jill, yes.
Hi, how are you? Jill Pasternak from WRTI in Philadelphia.
How are you doing?
That's fine. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
Thank you so much for giving us your time.
Thank you.
We have known your name for so many, many years that you're a triple threat. You're a conductor, a violinist, a violist, and actually a marvelous educator as well. And it's very difficult to know where to start with you. Which do you prefer?
Well, anything you'd like to talk about, I'm happy to talk about.
Well, the conducting came a little bit later, didn't it?
It's around 1972.
Yes.
70, between 70 and 72, I was directing with English Chamber Orchestra.
Yes.
On the fiddle. And then I started progressively going away from the instrument and just conducting. And it's been about 30 years now.
Well, you've always been, of course, I'm a person who's been around for a while, and we always thought of you as a kind of an Israeli trio, you, Baron Boehm, and Perlman.
Yeah.
And but I think you've all really gone in different directions. Tell us a little bit about the attitude of, first of all, being a conductor as opposed to being, well, you never really were a member of the orchestra. You were always a soloist, weren't you?
Well, I never played professionally in an orchestra. I played at Juilliard.
Yes.
And then occasionally I would sit in to play in the back of a violin section in Chicago or in Berlin or Los Angeles where I really enjoy playing a symphony after I play a concerto or sometimes just at the rehearsal. It depends. I was learning the craft to some extent, mm-hmm. Sitting in the back of the section, but at the same time I was enjoying the music, playing in an orchestra. So professionally I never actually sat down, which is a very different story than occasionally doing it, you know.
Yes, well, you carry on the Baroque tradition of being a soloist / conductor.
Well, you know, these are all things that the 20th century, we put titles to everything.
Right.
I think that in my, where I come from is basically you can play and conduct if you know how to conduct. If you don't know how to conduct, don't do it.
I agree.
The fact that you can play doesn't mean automatically that you can conduct. And that's really where the problem begins.
Yes.
And so, and then said that where musically it stands is that anything with two horns, anything with above two horns, you know, the orchestration becomes too big. Anything with four horns to play and conduct is very, very difficult, and primarily because the orchestra can't really hear you well enough.
Mm-hmm.
The material itself may be bigger in scope as far as orchestration goes. It may not be an actual movement, physical movement, but you just can't hear well enough. So anything over four horns, above four horns in orchestration, in the literature, violin orchestra literature, violin
yes.
literature with orchestra should mm-hmm. not be conducted and played at the same time.
Well,
it
that's
has to
really,
be a separate
yeah.
conductor. And that's what basically a conductor was or is from the beginning of time. When the conductor became a professional, it was called Taktschläger, time beater.
Yes, a batteur.
Because
also
the orchestra
in French,
got
yeah.
so big. The yeah. orchestra got peripherally
right.
too big.
Mm-hmm.
And so people couldn't hear each other, so they needed somebody to lead. So consequently, what you got is a leader. You got a concertmeister, or you got somebody from the keyboard, or eventually in sort of 1800s onwards, we got the conductor. And in the 20th century, sort of around 1880, 1870, and so on, when Mahler and Wagner and Bruckner and all these big orchestrations took place, they became a conductor. But a conductor, as we know today, is relatively still a very new profession in music history.
Well, thank you. I know as a musician that has played with many conductors, there are a lot of them that aren't very good, but when they step up on that podium, they really take on a whole new persona. And I think that I would like your opinion in a sense of who makes the performance. If you haven't got a good orchestra, no matter how great a conductor you are, I think you have a problem.
There is no answer. You know, there is really no direct answer for the question you're asking. It's like asking an actor, how do they pronounce a certain word, or how do they deliver a particular line in a Shakespeare play or any other play for that matter. And that's really has to do with so many aspects. Most of it is under one title called knowledge. Mm-hmm. If you have knowledge, you should be able to do it. What comes after knowledge in the conducting sense, and the same as actors, and for that matter, a ball player, you have to have the physical dexterity. It doesn't mean you have to be perfect, but you have to have a physical dexterity that explains a D major chord to 170 eyes. That's, or a D minor chord. That's really what it's about at the end of the day. So a conductor getting on the podium within a minute or less, the musicians will say, yes, that's good. Mm-hmm. They won't say great, but they'll say good, if it's good. If it's lousy, they won't say anything. They'll just go along and do their thing and go home. So that's where we are. And that's really essentially the whole ballgame is life. It's a life ongoing study of how to do it. And you can create D major in one way, you can create D major in another way. You find your way of explaining what you want to do, but you've got to have the musical integrity and knowledge, and then comes an enormous amount of life experiences. And that is a whole bunch of things. It has to do with children, it has to do with political situations.
Well, I think that goes for any artist, but of course when you're transmitting the knowledge to the orchestra, that's I think what you're talking about in terms of technically, but there is so much more than that, and I guess...
people will tell you, Giulini, for example, was a great master. He looked awkward, but everybody understood what he wanted to do. Mm-hmm. Toscanini, on the other hand, was incredibly clear. And again, it was not, he was absolutely clear and nobody had a problem with it. And it goes on like that. So these are the bookends, if you like. I mean, one was so awkward looking and yet the music just flew right out of him and there was no question what to do or how to do it. And with Toscanini, it was very clear. So, you know, these are all objective things that musicians will talk about. When they see a conductor, there are ways of teaching a little bit of the craft. What I mean by a little bit, there is a way to tell someone how to transmit a particular message that's on the printed page. And we do that here in the summertime. We have a course for conductors. It's not easy, and it takes a while before they feel comfortable with standing on the podium because you are subject to 150 eyes at any given time.
And a lot of criticism, I think, too.
Well, the eyes alone are criticizing right there. So.
Right. But did you study conducting?
Sure. I studied at Juilliard for a little bit. And then basically I really worked myself with being around extraordinary icons. Mm-hmm. I mean, I played with the Kubeliks and the Münches and the Krips and all these people and Doratis. And so I learned an enormous amount about not only conducting, but how you behave in front of an orchestra, what do you do, how do you say good morning, for example. I mean, you say good morning to an orchestra, they can tell if you're okay or not, you know. and so these are all very important aspects. Of course, being around these incredible musicians, I learned so much about music as well. So it was a combination. Chamber music is essential to all music making. And that's why an orchestra is an enlarged sense.
A chamber ensemble, sure.
The same thing.
You have to listen, I guess. With chamber music, you really have to listen.
Yeah.
And I guess that's the right answer as well. With a huge orchestra, you do too. I mean,
all the time.
Yes, always. Well, I have another question to ask you. You probably have been asked this a number of times, and my motivation is just to get information. What happened with, of course, you're an Israeli, this whole business of playing Wagner and so on and so forth. Whatever happened with that? I know there was some, they took exception to playing it in Israel, and then I think they started to, and then they stopped. Is that right?
No, they didn't really start. I think officially, nothing ever started. I think that Zubin tried with the Israel Philharmonic to play some Wagner at a given concert a couple of years ago, if I remember correctly, and they voted on it, and they voted again against it.
Against and again.
To not play. The Israel Philharmonic. Barenboim, on the other hand, Daniel came with his own orchestra.
He tried,
played,
yes. Mm-hmm.
And I think he played an encore or something like that, and there were some screams against that.
Yes.
He had to stop and turn around and made a speech. It's a whole geschäft. But
yes,
I have no real opinion on this. I can tell you that there's so much pain still involved in that memory.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that any pain that's inflicted, that should not be inflicted. The pain should not be inflicted. And if it's so, let it go. Just let it go, in my book. But again, I play Wagner outside of Israel because it's not associated with exactly that pain, even by Jews. So is it great music? Absolutely.
Yes.
You have to learn and know about it? Absolutely. Can you ever perform it, and should you perform it? Absolutely. But if it inflicts pain in a situation like Israel, with
yes.
all its
mm-hmm.
overtones and what it meant or didn't mean, let it go. Just let it go. I, for one, cannot do that. I won't do that. I won't inflict pain on people by making music. Why should I?
Well, of course.
That's all it is.
Yes.
And everybody deals with pain in a different way.
Yes.
You know? Intellectually, I think they should play it. Emotionally, I'm not sure they can.
Mm.
And so if they can't, I leave it alone. You know, I'm not that kind. I'm not a hard ass to that extent. I just am not.
Well, I think you're a humanitarian as well. I mean, I think you're right about that, but it puts a lot of, it's just an issue. And again, it's very objective for me, but I just wondered about the art in general. I mean, does one rule out certain aspects of art because of what has happened in history politically? It's a very, very
well,
difficult
I don't rule
decision.
It out. As a musician, I've learned and I play. In fact, I'm doing Meistersinger Overture here in about 2 weeks. I've done Wagner here before. I've done Wagner in other places. So I don't exclude it at all. In fact, I find it extraordinary. And I think the whole issue of Wagner and its history, that's something we can sit down someday and talk about. But the fact that it was used or had been used, mm. right or wrong, it was used in some form
under
that
the circumstances.
Is very painful to a lot of people. So why inflict it on? And if it's by law, not allowed. I mean, it's actually not allowed.
Is that right? I see.
It's like defecating mm-hmm. the Statue of Liberty. You wouldn't do that.
Right. Well, I
so
agree.
So why, you know, that's not exactly the right thing, it's not synonymous with exactly that, because the music is fantastic.
Mm.
But again, I study it, I look at it, I listen to it. But the political ramifications, I try to stay apolitical as much as I can in all issues, on all issues that have to do with music, because it should be apolitical. It should not become political at all.
That's an interesting approach, certainly, I think.
You know, I remember in 71 in Berlin, when the Israel Philharmonic was on tour, first time since the war, 71. So we're talking about 16, 17 years, something like that, that the first time the Israel Philharmonic went officially to a German-speaking the German-speaking world again. And Barenboim, myself, and Zubin was conducting, and we played in Berlin. And Zubin played Hatikva, which
mm-hmm.
is our hymn.
Of course,
you know,
sure.
For encore.
In
after
Berlin,
Mahler,
oh my.
I think it was Mahler 1, and nobody knew what the piece was.
Oh my.
So, you know, would they know the Star-Spangled Banner? I don't know. So, you know, he didn't do it in the beginning of the concert, which is sometimes the tradition to do both hymns, because the German hymn also was something that's connected. Even though it's by Haydn, it's connected to that time period of the Holocaust and all its horrible endings. So in history. So there was a vote not to do that. But so he decided, Zubin, on the spur of the moment, said, okay, let's do Hatikva for Encore. And nobody stood up. They actually were sitting and played it for Encore. And everybody said, oh, what a beautiful tune. You know?
Yes. Unbelievable.
So, you know, there you go. It's the opposite, isn't it? It's the other side of the stick.
Well, when you hear it and you don't know what it is, I guess the judgment is not colored. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Really unbelievable. Now, you, of course, will be doing a concert for Knesset Israel. It's their 160th anniversary, I believe. Oh. And also launching a music arts series, I think, that they're going to be carrying on. So this is on October 7th. You will be appearing with your newest ensemble, the Zuckerman Chamber Ensemble, the Zuckerman Chamber Players?
As we call it, ZCP, fondly ZCP. It's five of us that have been playing now together for about 45 years, and it stems out of the orchestra here. There are members, three members out of the orchestra here are all wonderful players. They're all well. One of them happens to be my wife.
I was just going to say, I didn't want to. She's very beautiful too. So,
well, that's the added bonus.
That's right. Yeah, and
two of them are former students, but it has nothing to do with one of them. In fact, is from Curtis. Jessica.
Yes.
Went to Curtis and lived with our wonderful people there. You know, that are putting on the concert.
That's the Bildersees certainly are very much involved in them.
Yeah, so
in that.
It's very nice to come home. To tell them, Same. You know, Ellen and Robert are amazing people.
Yes, I know them.
You know, she calls them, you know, she calls them parents, you know.
I know that she says they're her children, yeah. Her daughters.
Yeah, and also Yuja
Wang, yes.
And Yuja is living with them. So they're just fabulous people. And it's, when they suggested this a couple of years ago, I said, sure, let's do it. No problem. You know, so it's taken that long to put it together, but it's a terrific thing. They've heard us play. They know Jessica, of course. So it's all for me. We're actually going home. In a way, it's like going home to play. It's very nice.
It's wonderful. Well, also, the theme of the whole event is the passing of the Torah. I mean, they said from generation to generation, and you as an artist are passing your knowledge, I guess, from generation to generation, if you want to look at the larger sense.
That's very nice. I didn't know.
Yes, that's what it is, basically. But of course, you know, whenever you play, you've got a fabulous audience. I heard you play with Itzhak Perlman in Philadelphia not too long ago.
Yeah.
And believe it or not, I was in Santa Fe when you were with the Philadelphia, the Chamber Ensemble, and we used your Shostakovich, part of that piano trio, on our show last week because I did a show about the Santa Fe Chamber Festival and the opera. So you were already on WRTI, which is we're running the chamber music series as well for 13 weeks. That was quite a performance.
Criticizing you.
That was quite a performance of the Shostakovich. We didn't play much of it, but
yeah.
What a work. Again,
oh,
what a work.
Great piece.
I got a press kit about you, and I knew a lot about you, of course, through the years. But I was also fascinated by this virtual teaching thing that you're doing and planning to do, because we are going to be doing something very similar here at the radio station, believe
it
or not.
Right.
And tell us a little bit about that particular project.
Well, I came across this technology about 1992 or so, and it was really an extraordinary moment for me because I realized at the time, or at least I thought I realized at the time, I went ballistic, as one of my daughter calls it.
You know,
I saw the print, the audio, and the video all streaming at the same
Amazing.
Time.
Amazing, yeah.
Already then. The technology itself, as you probably know, has been in existence for quite a while, in medicine for sure, and in the military. Now, of course, it's on everybody's lips. This video conferencing, or better known as broadband.
Right, okay.
Live interaction.
Right.
And what I saw, of course, immediately is a way to go back to my students, or the students that I was teaching, or beginning to teach at the Manhattan School of Music, because with travel and all, I just couldn't see them all the time, which would have been a problem, accumulated problem, because as you know, young folks need continuity.
And if you're traveling a lot as well.
And even though I have the most extraordinary, and we work together and have for a long, long time, Patty Kopek, she's really the one that sees them every week. Nevertheless, with this technology, I could actually be there from any place. it was rather amateurish in the beginning. I used to have to run to conference rooms in a bank sometimes. Mm-hmm. I did a broadcast once from, a live interaction from Tokyo. I was 1 o'clock in the morning for me, and I had to actually get the janitor to open the door, and he didn't know how to turn on the machine.
That's a very glamorous field music, you know.
But for teaching and helping young people, I'll do anything. That's the next generation. That's the people that are going to carry the torch. They have to be given a chance to know and to see what I've learned anyway, and I share it with them. So it's really enabled me to go back to the school. Subsequently, over the last 15 years or so, there's so much, well, I guess 13 years, there's so much that has come into our world, you know, with the computer.
Sure.
There's no question in my mind that everything is not as changing as much as altering the way we think and the way we look at things. And eventually, in very short time, we'll be expanding this technology to the arts in a way that nobody ever even imagined. And it's now beginning to happen. The webcasts, for example, are there. Archival stuff is being used in a different way. It's beginning to be more accessible. Downloading has become, you know, vocabulary that we use probably every sentence. Why don't you download that picture to me? Why don't you download that?
Yes, it's part of it. Well, you can download this interview because we have an archive and we stream on the net. So,
but imagine if you said download 5 years ago. Say, what?
No, it's
download?
Amazing. Yeah. Amazing.
So
amazing.
Video conferencing has brought and has broken down barriers, obviously, between people and between nations and adversaries. It has also given a chance to understand each other a little bit better, because you cannot speak in your mother tongue and automatically gets translated. So there are no ifs or buts. What did you say? What do you mean by that? You know, that kind of thing? Mm-hmm. Through a translator. So that's a very great enhancement, and it is an enhancement. I must remind you and a few other people, I've been at this for a very, very long time. If you use or begin to use it as a substitute for shortcuts or any other things that human nature sometimes makes us do, that's a mistake, and it's a big mistake. It'll come back and bite you big time in real time. And so it's not a substitute for anything. There is no substitute for a real teacher. And the physical
presence,
moment,
yeah,
when you shake somebody's hand. But it doesn't mean that we shouldn't use this as an enhancement to be able to shake somebody's hand and know already who they are. And that's the beauty of what's happening here.
Now, when you teach, are you on a coaching level, or do you, I mean, you don't really start with your students as far as, it's mostly interpretation, isn't it?
It depends. No. It depends. I do a lot of fundamental work. I do it myself every day with scales and getting the sound back in shape and intonation. So I do it with them. Fundamentals are very important. They go hand in hand for me with interpretation or with feelings of music and so on. Because for every nuance, there is a verbal explanation that's how we teach.
Mm-hmm.
The euphoria of performance and the moment that takes place on the stage, that has nothing to do with it. In the teaching concept, for every nuance on the page, for every feeling that you have, there is a physical
way of doing it. Yes,
absolutely.
No question.
And there must be.
Yes.
There must be. If there isn't, then it's faking.
Now I want to ask you something. How do you do it all? How you personally, you conduct, you are a violinist, you play the viola, which is a bit different from the violin in terms of spacing. And I mean, when you go out, say, with Perlman, and you do your series, you know, the series of concerts that you did, you were playing viola, weren't you, all the time, or were you switching?
Yeah, I was switching.
Mm-hmm. But does it bother you?
That's not that difficult.
Not a problem.
No, none of it is a problem. Look, this morning, for example, 9:15, I went to the violin case, I opened it up, and I practiced 45 minutes of scales, and I played some Bach, and it makes me a better person. And
oh, yes, it does. You're the second person that said that most recently to me, that
it's
Bach
true.
Makes you a better person. It's very structured, and it tells you exactly where you are and where you're going. Yeah.
Exactly.
And where you're going, of course, is a wonderful a wonderful place, and I just can't tell you how thrilled I am to speak with you and hope to see you at Knesset Israel on October 7th. And thank you so very much for giving us so much time, Maestro.
Thank you for calling me.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.